I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Michelle Orange describes her mother's decision to pursue a business career as a neoclassical epic of self-determination. In a new book, Orange explores what her mother's choices meant for their relationship and the tradition of feminism that has shaped both of their lives. Michelle Orange joins me to talk about her memoir, Pure Flame, A Legacy. Plus, as COVID restrictions are lifted, the performing arts are slowly ending their long pandemic pause. Today on Midday, two prominent local choral conductors, Dr. Eric Conway of Morgan State University and Anthony Blake Clark of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society, look ahead to the future of choral singing post-pandemic. That's all coming up on Midday after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you're spending part of your day with us. Yesterday, Governor Larry Hogan announced that the state will be ending the $300 supplemental payments to those folks who are unemployed. These are federal programs that had been extended until September under the American Rescue Plan Act. Congress passed that legislation back in March. A number of other Republican governors have done the same thing. Maryland is the 24th state to stop these federally subsidized extra payments for unemployed folks. The business community, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and many others, have called for the states to end these enhanced benefits because they are citing various businesses' needs for hiring workers. And the theory is that people are staying home with their unemployment rather than seeking employment. We're going to talk about this Friday on Midday with members of both the Republican and Democratic caucuses of the Maryland legislature. So wanted to get you up to date on that bit of news from yesterday. My first guest today is Michelle Orange. She's an author based here in Baltimore and in Brooklyn, New York, who has contributed to The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, The New York Times, and many other publications. She also teaches writing at Columbia University and Goucher College. Her 2013 collection of essays called This Is Running for Your Life was critically acclaimed. Her new book is in part a memoir, a rumination on feminism and a cultural history. We're going to talk about that book today. It is centered around her mother. Her mother did what most mothers did not do in the 1970s. She went to graduate school, she got an MBA, and she rose to the top as a CEO of a big agency. Her story became a case study in business schools in the mid-1980s. Her choices were the subject of great debate, and they came at a price. Michelle Orange's book is an elegant disquisition on what that price was and how it was paid. It's called Pure Flame, A Legacy, and Michelle Orange joins us from Brooklyn, New York. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
So what are your aspirations with this book? Because as I mentioned, it's not, you know, exclusively a memoir of your mom and your relationship with your mom. It's considerably more. It branches out into these wonderful disquisitions about feminism. I just wonder, as you started this project, what did you hope the reader would get out of it?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. And I've gone back to thinking about it myself because the beginnings of this project feel so long ago now. But one of the starting points really was an essay by a writer named Vivian Gornick, who I admire a lot. And it's an essay in which she talks about the way that from Oedipus to Freud, the way that we've told stories about what she calls the struggle to be in the world have generally used father-son constructions. And she makes this, what I found at the time to be a really persuasive argument that in fact, in a modernized world, and certainly in a world that has seen such incredible change for women's rights, at least in this part of the world, it's actually the mother-daughter construction that holds so much more ambivalence and richness when it comes to telling these stories about how to enter the world, how to leave one's family, how to leave one's mother specifically. And I was really persuaded by that essay, and I thought, for one thing, I felt the lack of those kind of stories in my own life that might have helped me make sense of my own experience, my own relationships with my mother, and perhaps hers with her mother. And also just felt the need for them, and began to consider, you know, how one might tell such a story, and kind of make it epic in some sense, in a way that made sense to me. So yeah, I suppose my aspiration was really to try and find, to give that to readers and to connect with those readers who maybe shared that hunger.
It's interesting because I'm sure this is purely coincidental, mm-hmm. but last week, or maybe the week before, I spoke to a woman also from Brooklyn named Michelle Zahner. She is a musician. She has a band called Japanese Breakfast. And she wrote a terrific book called Crying at H Mart, which is somewhat similar to yours in that it is about this situation with her mom, who had a long-term illness, and Michelle took care of her, and this is about that relationship. And next week, I'm going to talk to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who's just published a book called On Grief, where she, you know, contemplates the grief that she felt at the death of her father and actually her mother. Her mom died after the book was published, but she's, you know, obviously incorporated that into her thinking about that. So there seems to be a whole spate of these books of people remembering their parents in beautiful and eloquent ways. So, I'm delighted to have read yours, which I think is a wonderful contribution to the genre. But I didn't sort of even realize it was a genre until I realized, you know, all the people who are appearing on Midday. Tell us about your mom.
You know, she's someone who part of what the book charts is the idea that I really only got to know my mom in a way that I could tell you about her in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years of her life. She was someone who was born in a, you know, sort of working class family and grew up in the 50s and 60s, got a university degree, was the first in her family of either gender to do that, and married my father right out of university, and kind of set aside her professional goals or ambitions, as a lot of women in that era did, even the ones who went on to get higher education. And they, you know, married, moved, got a house, and started on the family. And I think, you know, it was in the 70s, the late 70s, when my brother and I were small, that she sort of realized that maybe the bargain that she'd signed up for wasn't all it was, she thought it was going to be. And she was afraid for her marriage, frankly, and afraid of what would happen if it were to break up and she were to be on her own, and decided to go back to school. She applied to law school. She applied to business school. She wanted a professional degree that would help her support herself. And so it was in her late 30s, early 40s that she sort of re-embarked on a new and a different life, and very quickly hit the quote-unquote glass ceiling in London, Ontario, where we lived at the time, and was presented with an opportunity to get a much better job in a bigger city, Toronto, but she would have to move there. And she decided to take that opportunity and commuted for many years. My parents' marriage didn't actually end until I had graduated from high school. But she was someone who I knew only sort of remotely. And as I get into in the book, I knew her as an extraordinary figure, but also a figure of an anger that I couldn't fathom. And we just sort of orbited each other in these detached ways for much of my adult life. And her career got bigger and bigger. She had a tremendous appetite for travel and for beauty and for fine things. When she was close to 60, she met a man and fell in love and married and retired in really quick succession. And it was at that point, you know, and I was around 30 at that time that I realized that I didn't know my mother at all. And my assumptions about her and her decisions, I really needed to reevaluate them. And, you know, it was more years until I decided to look more, you know, in a more considered way, in a way that would lead to something like a book at her life and at our relationship. But yeah, she was full of surprises.
The book is called Pure Flame, A Legacy. My guest is its author, Michelle Orange. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. And you write that when you were a little kid, your mom would leave, I guess, Sunday night or Monday morning, go to work in Toronto for the week and come home on the weekends. Now, even though she was coming home every weekend, you write that you always just assumed she was gone for good. So why do you think that is? She did keep coming home every weekend, but this was very disruptive to you and your family that she was not there Monday through Friday.
I think I had that sense, and I wrote about it the way I did because I had a sense of how unhappy she was. And that didn't, it wasn't that I sensed that she really preferred to be in Toronto, although I think that was ultimately true. It's that our home came to represent all of this disappointment for her, and a sort of story that she had believed in that had turned out to be tainted in a way that, you know, neither of us or any of us was able to confront directly for a very, very long time. And so I think that was behind my feeling of her goneness, even when she was present.
And her story gets picked up by business schools. It ends up in the Harvard Business Review, and it's a case study that graduate students in business studied and debated quite vociferously and quite interestingly. She was called, or the character in this study was called Janice Jerome. That's not her real name. Tell us about how this became a somewhat celebrated case study for business schools and how you found out about it from your mom.
Yeah, so Janice Jerome is, as you say, the name given to this character in a case study that really lays out the story up to my mother's decision to leave our home and go to another city for a job opportunity, a really good job opportunity. And originally, I think, you know, after my mother died, I was able to speak to one of the people who wrote the study. It was designed as a way for business students to talk about fit, like a employee fit at an you know, place of employment. The idea that this place where Janice worked wasn't able to retain her. She had discovered that they don't specify that it was a man. They only do it sort of obliquely. At one point in the study, had been hired who didn't have an MBA, whereas Janice did, and was being paid significantly more than she was. And when Janice complained about it, she was just sort of brushed away. And that was part of her determination to leave and to be valued for what she had to offer. But when it was brought to students, at the end of the study, there are all these questions. Should Janice leave? Should Janice stay? You know, what do you think about Janice? How do you feel about Janice? And students reacted incredibly negatively to Janice. So much so that the authors of the study and the professors who were teaching it realized they had to kind of recalibrate the whole thing and maybe turn it into more of a gender bias study and add to the mix a Jack Jerome who has the exact same story in every particular, but the pronouns are changed and the name is changed. And what they found was that students reacted, you know, in the opposite direction. And of course, Jack should take the job. He'd do it for his family and you know, his what's best for Jack is best for his family. And so from there, a whole other paper was generated a few years later, talking about these different responses and drawing certain conclusions from them. I didn't know anything about this until I'd actually been working on the book for a year and a half, when my mother and I were having another sort of casual discussion actually about my work prospects. And, she's just sort of mentioned casually, "Well, you remember Janice Jerome?" And I said, "I don't, you know, tell me about it." I often think now, what if she just hadn't raised it casually, you know, that day? Because it certainly changed. It didn't change the entire direction of my book, but it added a huge dimension to it.
You write about a woman named Caroline Knapp, who wrote an essay about feminism. Caroline Knapp came of age in the 1970s, and she observed that she felt that the movement of feminism had stalled into irrelevance over the decade that we're talking about, when your mom made this decision to take this job in a different city. And much of the book is a rumination on what that means for you personally. I was intrigued by that. You write towards the end of the book, "I remain unsure what it meant to be a woman, whether I qualified or cared to. My new normal involved a strict preoccupation with those questions and a related, more casual relationship to risk." So how do you think now, ultimately, looking back, this has informed your capacity for risk, your willingness to try things the way your mom tried things at a time that so few women were trying those things?
It's interesting. I mean, that question of womanhood and agency is certainly the one, or one of the major ones, that I was interested in starting out with this book. And as you say, one of the things I write about is my own detachment from, a sense of how my gender might define me or inform my choices. I think by the end of the book, I had a different my preoccupations, I suppose, shifted, or the way that I looked at the questions that I was trying to ask changed. And I think my relationship to risk, and that is to say, I became more interested in the question of what it is to live a full life. And certainly looking at my mom's life, and I write at one point in the book, one of the things I'm most appreciative of that I gained was a larger sense of just her appetites, her watching her grieve her own life, which had become so full and so full of love and fulfilled. It was obviously incredibly painful, but it also was a huge motivator, gaining a fuller sense that what it is to live is to understand that you're going to die, and that of course you weigh every decision in a larger balance. But it's not that I ever held great resentment about my mother's choice to move away. If anything, I understand it so much more fully now that I have the larger context, and even in writing this book, that I did some work to try and put it in an even greater, historical and cultural context. I take inspiration from her in that regard. She took risks, and I don't think she had a lot of regrets, honestly.
Pure Flame, A Legacy is the name of the book. Michelle Orange is the author. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. I was also intrigued by a quote that you have from Gloria Steinem. She was appearing on the Bill Maher show, and she was in her early 80s, and she observed that men tend to get more conservative as they get older because they gain power with age, but women get more radical because they lose power with age. Do you think your mom, and of course, as she got older, she was also fighting a very severe bronchial disease. Her lungs were failing her over a long period of time. Do you feel that, she sensed in a very real way her loss of power when her career was over? Because as you said, she made the decision to end her career pretty quickly after she married for the second time. I wonder how you assess your mom's, reckoning with her agency and power herself, and how you assess yours.
Well, I mean, my joke at the time when my mother decided to retire, no one was more surprised than I was. I think I say in the book, I thought she was going to die, sort of at a conference table somewhere. But instead, I actually part of why I had to recalibrate so much of what I thought I understood about my mother is that she could not have been happier to leave her career behind, and that her attachment to career was not as absolute as I had assumed it was. She continued doing some part-time work, you know, board work and things like that, but she was ready to lay down, you know, the sort of the sword, you know, like she'd been working from, you know, 12, 13, 14 hour days for her much of her adult life. And it had really taken a punishing toll on her. So I actually think that she felt more powerful and more empowered to make a decision that had more balance, offered her more a more fulfilled life. And she really took issue with that Steinem quote. She felt that the opposite was true, that women, at least in her own experience, it wasn't, I think she said, until her 40s that she felt like she could speak up and assert herself and act on her desires and go into the world and get for herself what it was she wanted. You know, it's the experience of the illness that was that complicated that so much, because part of the story that I think I told myself for a long time and that I wanted to confront in this book is that her career had really hurt her health, you know, that and it's not that I don't think that that's true at this point, but, you know, it's always more complicated than that. You know, she developed these severe pneumonias when she really started going, you know, into the hard charging corporate world, and she didn't take care of them particularly well. And so they developed into this lung disease that eventually took her life. So, you know, I think it was incredibly painful for her to weaken. She kept her illness a secret for a very long time until she couldn't anymore. I think that speaks to her, both her pride and her privacy and her conception of herself as someone who could be in control, you know.
You write very compellingly about beauty. You tell us that your mom was a beautiful woman by the standards of the day, or the maybe their universal standards of all time. I don't quite know. And obviously, I mean, she was, you know, in her 70s when she passed, and you know, so beauty is something that women have a very different relationship with than men do, or at least many men, certainly that I do. I'm the last person in the world to talk about beauty. I think my wife is very beautiful, and that's about as far as I get. And she is indeed very beautiful by all sorts of standards. But when you think about it, you say that you suffered more acutely in my relationship to those norms of beauty than she ever did. And why do you think that is? Is that because your generational difference, you know, the needle had moved? What do you think is different about your understanding of beauty and hers?
Well, first I want to ask you about your relationship, your own relationship to your beauty. But what is the answer to that question? I think I was always fascinated by my mother's, I don't know if I'd call it a lack of vanity, but she just wore her beauty very easily. And I don't know how to explain that. And that may be part of all the things that she was able to hide well, I'm not sure. I would really have to sort of speculate here. I think because I'm not as beautiful as she was, and I never felt as beautiful as she was. And perhaps because I grew up in a time that was even more image saturated than hers. And the ideals just kept getting more and more strict. I mean, perhaps that's why I may have also just had a harder time trying to figure out, how to exist in the world and what to measure myself against. And there was a lot of suffering that came out of that. I think maybe there's a sort of bittersweetness to the extent to which roles were very clearly defined when my mother grew up. You know, it was more of a struggle for me to, you know, figure out what beautiful was.
Michelle Orange, the book is called Pure Flame, A Legacy. Michelle Orange will be speaking about her book with the author Jeannie Venasco on the back patio, the Ivy Bookshop, Friday evening at 6:30. We've got a link to that event on the Midday webpage. Thanks so much, Michelle, and good luck with the book. It's a very interesting and intriguing treatise on a lot of different things. I enjoyed talking to you about it. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Such a pleasure.
Coming up, two choral conductors. We'll talk about how their choruses have coped with COVID-19. Dr. Eric Conway and Anthony Blake Clark will join me on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.